You are listening to The Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and 32 years have passed since the release of the first Jurassic Park movie, now a cinema classic. For today's episode, we are revisiting the original franchise through an animal rights perspective. As the multi-billion dollar biotech firm Colossal is seriously considering opening its own Jurassic Park, let's examine closely the impact and legacy of those 90s era movies. To discuss this topic, I have with me Alex Ventimiglia Sanchez, a professor of the English and Film Studies Department of the University of Alberta. He is also part of the team behind the amazing egg-truth.com initiative. Among other things, I asked Alex, why does our sense of wonderment towards animals makes us want to abuse them? Do vegans deceptively make animals appear like children? Do we exploit animals because of our conditioning or human nature? Visit the episode's notes and connect with Alex and the egg-truth.com project. Also, a friendly reminder to share this episode with your people. Subscribe or follow the show if you haven't. Leave a good review. Your support of this independent podcast means the world to me. Thank you. It's really fun to have a pretext to talk about dinosaurs and Jurassic Park. I'm feeling nostalgic. This was a big theme of my childhood. Dinosaurs, I loved them. I collected, you know, figurines of dinosaurs. And I watched Jurassic Park maybe 100 times. I loved that movie so much. And I'm talking about the original version, you know, with
right.
with the puppet dinosaurs, not the CGI versions. Do we share the same passion for dinosaurs?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, so first off, I agree, any opportunity to talk about dinosaurs in general, but Jurassic Park in particular, I think, is something that I treasure. I have lots of memories that revolve around dinosaurs. It was like, you know, as you said, it was an obsession of mine when I was a kid, and actually I didn't quite outgrow it until recently, I think, and that's only because I, you know, life has thrown so many things at me that I don't really have much time to indulge in that. But, you know, when I was a kid, one of my first memories is actually watching, not Jurassic Park, not originally, The Land Before Time, over and over and over again. It was a bit of an obsession of mine. There was a time when I was I got an eye injury, and I was supposed to be mostly in bed for a couple of months. And then my parents got me that movie, and I just ended up watching it over and over again. I think that's where my obsession came from. And then when Jurassic Park came out, I was a little kid, but I begged my parents to let me go watch it in the theater, and so they took me. And now it's a bit of a tradition of mine now to watch it at least once a year. Right. It's a movie that I keep coming back to, and in many ways it informs what I do now. Maybe not in a very direct way, but I think it became sort of my inspiration for a lot of ideas that I think about and with, even today in my research.
I believe that we have not yet assimilated, the fact that dinosaurs have existed into, you know, our culture and you know, cognition as a culture. And I think there should have been something like a philosophical reckoning with the first skeletons of dinosaurs, but nothing. It did not make people question, you know, core beliefs that we have created as a species. Let me just add, I feel the same way about Darwin. I feel like that, you know, when he came up with theory of evolution and talked about how the difference between humanity and the rest of the animal kingdom is a difference of degrees and not of nature, this should have caused an earthquake philosophically for the entire species, but nothing, not even a ripple.
Yeah, you know, I would qualify that claim, because I think that in many ways it did, but perhaps not to the degree that you would expect. Because I think part of what you're referencing right now is this popular understanding of the human species as unique still, right? This human exceptionalism that most people still subscribe to, even if on the surface they might say, well, actually, you know, people are just animals at the end of the day, right? They might say that on the surface, but I think subconsciously, or perhaps ideologically, they still subscribe to this idea of humanity as being exceptional in some ways, right? So I think that's sort of what you're referencing. But I think once you start digging a little deeper, you see that actually both the theory and evolution and dinosaurs in particular, prehistory, have actually shaped pockets of society to an incredible extent. So just to give you an example, right? One of the courses that I'm teaching, well, the course that I'm teaching right now, one of the texts that I ask my students to read is Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, right? And there are many references in that book to the theory of evolution. And the references are always made with an eye to how it informed scientific racism, right? So not all of the impact was good, obviously, right? I think people took Darwin's ideas and drew some conclusions that are misinformed. But it did shape a number of things, or a number of historical developments to some extent, for example, colonialism, right? But it also shaped other things. So for instance, the way in which concepts from prehistory, paleontology, and particularly the concept of mass extinction, right, which comes from deep time, which comes from paleontology, from our understanding of the Earth now, as opposed to like 300 years ago when we still thought that maybe it was just a few thousand years old, right? So our understanding of deep time and the many, prehistoric developments that led up to the origin of humankind and all that, I think that is something that again, perhaps only subconsciously, and perhaps only a few people are actively talking about this, but it informs our understanding of today, right? So now today we talk a lot about things like global warming, for example, climate change, right? And part of that conversation is the concept of the sixth mass extinction, which is kind of the focus of my research in some ways. And, you know, mass extinctions are not, like, that concept is not very old, right? It was first proposed in the 70s, and for a couple of decades, it was essentially thought of as ridiculous, right? Because the one of the things that Charles Darwin's theory of evolution proposed was that changes were gradual, that they were slow, right? That there were no catastrophes. And then suddenly come the Alvarezes. So Walter Alvarez and Luis Alvarez, based in California, they were the ones who first identified first proposed the theory of mass extinction, the first explained the extinction of the dinosaurs as possibly being the result of this asteroid colliding, right? And they went around the world looking for evidence, and they found it, right? And so I think with that comes this realization of just how even the most powerful species or the most powerful creatures on Earth are vulnerable to extinction, right? And I think that sort of fear haunts society today, because we're seeing catastrophic changes around the world. And I think subconsciously, perhaps, right, we're thinking, well, if it happened to the dinosaurs, it could happen to us. And that fear, that specific way of thinking about humanity and our destiny is part of Jurassic Park, right? You might recall this scene. They're in the car, right? They're in the car and they're waiting for the T-Rex to show up. And they kind of jokingly talk about how God creates dinosaurs, God kills dinosaurs, God creates people kill God, people create dinosaurs, and then dinosaurs eat people, right? So it's they're making explicit what is sort of implicit in the movie and also in evolutionary biology, which is if it happened to the dinosaurs, it can happen to us, right? So I think in that sense, it did make a fairly big splash, but it's not perhaps that the place or the credit that should be given to biological sciences, evolutionary sciences, and paleontology is not given, right? And that's why perhaps you have this impression of it not being all that prominent. But I think it's there. It's just it's kind of sneaky, right? But it's there, I think.
Before getting into the movie itself and the topic of dinosaurs, I just want to address the question of their appearance. So as a kid, I always imagined them as being reptilian. And of course, I came across, you know, the articles talking about how, no, actually, T-Rex might have had feathers and might have been those big chicken birds, you know. So what is your opinion on that? Or where is the science on that? I haven't, you know, checked. Did dinosaurs have feathers or not?
Oh, yeah, I think the evidence has definitely piled up on the side of dinosaurs being essentially birds. One of the moments that I remember most, I've been on Earth like since I was a kid, right? And so I collected National Geographic magazines from the time I was like 10. I had a huge collection. I don't have it anymore. But at some point, I had like volume upon volume of National Geographic. And one of my favorite volumes was the one that announced the first discovery of a fossilized dinosaur that was so well preserved that you could see the traces of feathers on its body, right? And how scientists were debating, okay, are these actually feathers, or is it maybe like some other structure on their skin, or perhaps underneath their skin that kind of looks like feathers, right? But then after that original discovery, now it's paleontology works in a rather funny way, right? You have to know where to look, but you can't know that in advance. So it was only once they realized where they could look for fossils that preserved what you call integument, right? The external structures of the animal. Once they knew where to look, they started looking there, right? And they started digging all over the place. And by now, I think the last time I checked was a couple of years ago, so I'm sure this is outdated, right? But at least 25 different species, many of them known from many skeletons, not just one, right, show distinct marks of feathers. And what's interesting is that these species are not all that closely related, right? Some of them are essentially just like little, you know, chicken looking thingies, right? And then there are some really big ones that are actually very closely related to T-Rex, for example, right? And some that are even related to Triceratops. So now the question is not whether they had feathers, but rather how feathered were they, depending on the species, right? So for example, the one that looks more like Triceratops, it only really has a few quills on its tail. So it might be that it only had feathers in certain parts of its body, right? But there were others that were essentially fully covered in feathers with like these incredible looking wings that are indistinguishable from the ones that birds have today, except that you can still see their fingers poking out, right? Our perspective of them has changed. And with that, again, our understanding of what killed them, right? Or if something indeed could be said to have eliminated all dinosaurs, because if we understand that birds are dinosaurs, then perhaps the story shouldn't be about how they went extinct, but rather how they had to adapt, right? And I think in that there is a lesson for us, right? Because we've been doing things a certain way for the better part of 500 years, and I don't think it's working, right? So perhaps we shouldn't be striving to get ever bigger and greater, and like we shouldn't have this idea of like progress meaning bigger and grander things, but rather finding a way to persevere despite a changing landscape, right?
I don't like the idea that dinosaurs had feathers. I really don't like that. It's the same as...
Can I ask you a question, though? Because yes. I think sometimes that is more the result of people not liking birds in general. Something that I've learned is that a lot of people are afraid of birds. Would you say that applies to you? Do they make you uncomfortable?
No, I have a couple of birds, budgies, that I take care of at home. They're
right.
I see their personality and how smart they are, and right. I have no difficulty imagining them being dinosaurs.
Right.
They could have been, you know, part of that Jurassic Park franchise. they're just villains. They really are. But yeah, it's weird how it becomes distasteful for us to imagine those dinosaurs as having feathers. It's like the Greek statues having collars.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah, I think you get used to a certain mode of representation, and then when it changes, you know, you don't like it. It's kind of like when people get older, they find contemporary music less and less likable, right? Because it no longer resembles what you experienced as a child. And I think that's perhaps a part of it. I was resistant too, you know, like the first time that these discoveries kind of like became the subject of popular culture, like through National Geographic, for example, or the first documentaries to show these CGI documentaries that show dinosaurs, right? Like I don't know if we're allowed to say brands, but there's a new one that came out, and they're covered in feathers, and I also thought that doesn't feel right. Right, yeah. So I know where you're coming from, but I do think that I prefer the other perspective that you offered, right? Looking at your birds, for example, your budgies, and thinking, huh, that's something dinosaurs might have done, right? I here in Edmonton, recently there was a vote to choose the city's official bird, right? And everybody just kind of agreed that it had to be the magpie. There are magpies everywhere. This is magpie country, right? And they are vicious. They are some of the most vicious birds I've ever seen, right? And I've seen all kinds of birds in the wild, right? Even I once had the fortune of seeing an osprey diving into I think it was a river, and, you know, actually catching a fish and flying off with it. And that was incredible, right? But there's something about a gang of magpies piling up on a rabbit that really feels prehistoric, right? I immediately picture velociraptors on a triceratops or something, right? And it's crazy because, like, magpies are not that big, right? And the jackrabbits here, they're pretty big. They don't care. They gang up on them. All right, they pick them. I'm not sure they actually hunt them. I don't know why they harass them so, but they do, and they're fearless, right? They actually gang up on my cat. You would think a cat would, you know, would drive him away, but no, they get together, they form these little packs, and I swear it's just like that scene in Jurassic Park at the end, right? When the family, well, not the family, but like the kids and the two paleontologists are together, and the raptors are approaching, right? That's my cat's experience on an everyday basis. He's surrounded by magpies, and he has nowhere to run. And he doesn't have a T-Rex to save him, so.
Yes, they're completely fearless. And there's also the fact that, you know, birds with their feathers, I associate that with, like, grace, and there's something very artistic, very, you know, it's something that civilized, that's something very, you know, it's the, it's what you see on the, you know, hats of nobles from, you know, the Middle Ages, that kind of thing. Yeah. So the idea of a bloodthirsty creature with feathers, you know, it's it doesn't have that primitive trait that reptiles do. You know, you look at reptiles and you think, yeah, this is from another era.
Yeah, that is true. And I think, again, right, I think that's where a lot of that resistance comes from, because I think there is something primeval about leathery, scaly skin, right? At least we perceive it that way. And you're right, feathers were traditionally associated with the aristocracy, for example, right? But again, I think it sort of depends on what your perception of birds is and how well informed it is. Because, and again, right, I remember this scene in Jurassic Park when, like, when Alan Grant, the paleontologist, is trying to explain to this kid how vicious raptors were, right? When he scares the crap out of that kid. And it all starts because the kid says, well, it doesn't look very scary. It's just like a turkey, right? And I, now when I go watch, I go back and watch that scene, I think, well, that kid has never met a turkey because turkeys are vicious animals, right? Like we think of, unfortunately, we associate them with things like Thanksgiving dinner, right? Because we've commodified them and we've exploited them. And in that process, we've made them very tame. But the wilder turkeys, right? Not even necessarily just like wild turkeys, but varieties of turkeys that have not been so thoroughly domesticated, they're vicious animals. And they're big, right? They're very big birds that, because they're ground dwelling, they have to come up with other kinds of defenses, right? They can't just take off and fly. They do fly, but that's a last resort, right? Their first resort is to be intimidating. And so they puff up, you know, they puff their feathers, they start making all these really weird noises, and they'll charge at you, right? So again, it sort of depends on how you look at birds and how you look at animals in general, right? There are things that we associate with animals that are not necessarily true. And I think one of them is, unfortunately, because of them, long-standing commodification of certain body parts, certain animal parts. We think of feathers as aristocratic and fanciful, but in reality, you know, they have a distinct evolutionary purpose, actually multiple purposes, and one of them can be intimidation, right? And I think there's something very scary about a bird that puffs up and starts making all these weird noises, right? Sometimes they hiss, right? Here we have like Canadian goose. Or Canada goose, I think is the right term, right? Canada goose are scary birds, right? And you look at it and it's like, it looks kind of cute. It's just like a big duck, but they're vicious, right? They're vicious animals. And I think, you know, getting over some of those misconceptions might help you accept feathered dinosaurs, although maybe not, right?
Yes. And that brings me to an iconic scene in Jurassic Park, which is the raptors hunting those children, the brother and sister, in the kitchen. And what is the most frightening in that scene is not so much their appearance, which is frightening, but their intelligence. That's what, you know, right. The scene tells us. Those killing machines, those really scary looking beasts are intelligent. They understand that you're trying to run away, and they can, you know, visualize and project and make plans to catch you. And that is the most the scariest part. What do you make of that? First of all, is it even accurate that they had that degree of intelligence? And then what do you make of how they highlight the intelligence as being the scary part?
Yeah, you know, that's that's a really good question, and something that I hoped that we could discuss today, because I think I cannot speak to the accuracy of it, because I'm also, first off, I'm not a paleontologist, right? I study like these things from a cultural perspective. I know that in terms of how paleontologists gauge the intelligence of an animal, usually they go, or the traditional method was not all that different from what zoologists have traditionally done, which is they look at a skull, they look at the brain cavity in that skull, and they say, well, you know, this one's bigger than the other. Presumably this animal's smarter than the other, right? Has more cognitive abilities in some ways. And so when that scene was made, and I've actually spoken to Jack Horner, who was the paleontological advisor for Jurassic Park. So when they made that scene, what they wanted to emphasize is that because these animals are big, right? Some of these dromaeosaurs, the raptors, some of the raptors were as big as the ones portrayed in Jurassic Park. They had big brains. Like dromaeosaurs as a whole family was. They generally had big brain cavities in their skulls, and so people or paleontologists assumed that they were smarter than most dinosaurs. And this particular species that was as big as a human, right, did have a fairly big brain, right? So the assumption was, well, okay, so if it has a brain as big as that of a chimp, then perhaps it's as smart as a chimp, right? Now, there was a lot of pushback against that from the paleontological community, saying that, well, you know, these are not chimps, these are not apes, these are not mammals, these are, at the time, right, they were still seen as primarily reptilian, even though already there are some hints of the fact that they are birds in Jurassic Park, right? So they thought, well, it might have had a big brain, but so do turtles. Like, some leatherback turtles have fairly big brains, and they're not particularly smart, right? All right, so now that our understanding of them has changed, and now we see them more as birds, I think the trajectory has sort of shifted, right? In the sense that, well, recognizing that they're birds and perhaps puts them, you know, you can look at a raptor skull and then perhaps a bird that's of similar size, like, say, I don't know, an ostrich maybe, right? Although I think ostriches have fairly small heads. And you can think, well, perhaps it was as smart as an ostrich, right? Or perhaps a little smarter than that. But even that is changing now, because now we know that when it comes to avian birds or the birds of brains, size doesn't matter as much as we used to think, right? You have budgies. So you have essentially parrots, right? Parrots as a whole don't have particularly big brains, but they're insanely smart. Right? Some species more than others. Traditionally, experiments on avian intelligence have been done with African gray parrots, which are like these fairly big-sized gray parrots from Central Africa, right? And I mean, they're incredibly smart, right? They can figure out puzzles. Some studies suggest that they do actually understand human speech. Like, they understand the correlation between sound and meaning, right? And so you can teach them basic grammatical constructs to communicate, and they seem to do a very good job at it, right? So if a bird that's the size of a crow, right, is potentially that smart with a brain that's not that big, how smart could dinosaurs have been? Who knows, right? Because, again, other birds that perhaps behave more like a raptor would, like magpies, crows, ravens, right? Corvids are now understood as perhaps even smarter than parrots. And again, brains that are not that big, and still they have cognitive abilities that we now think are at least as powerful as those of great apes, right? And there's a big difference between a chimp, right, which is the size of a person, essentially, and a raven, which is no bigger than a cat, with a brain that's no bigger than a cat's, but that seems to be as intelligent as great apes, right? So brain size, that is to say, doesn't really seem to matter when it comes to birds, right? It's more about the wiring of the brain and how densely packed their neurons are. So it is entirely possible, not to say that that is accurate, right? But I think it is entirely possible that large predatory dinosaurs in that family, the dromaeosaurs, the troodontids, the raptors, right, may have been as intelligent as they are depicted. Of course, this is all conjecture and it's impossible to figure out, but I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility, right? Because if we now understand that birds like parrots and crows and ravens are as smart as a five-year-old, right, but with predatory instincts, who knows what they could have accomplished, right? I mean, I don't know if you've been around a lot of kids in your life, like if you have nephews or kids or whatever, right? But five-year-olds are smart and they don't have a moral compass. So they're quite predatory. So imagine a pack of, like, you know, of creatures that are as big as a human, but with predatory instincts, not necessarily a moral compass, and, you know, and as intelligent as that. And I think, you know, what you see in that scene, right, coordinated behavior, you know, a theory of mind, right? Because I think that's perhaps one of the main things that I identify in those depictions of the raptors, that they have a theory of mind, that they understand what others are thinking, right? We know that birds can do that to some extent now. So is it possible? I think it's entirely possible. Do we know? No, and we can't find out, right? But I think it's fun to think about.
But why is it scary?
Because we're used to being top dog, right? I think, and again, I return to that scene with the kid and actually later scenes that sort of suggest how uncomfortable we are with predation once the tables are turned, right? I think, unfortunately, we have become accustomed to this idea of us being the undisputed top of the food chain, or however you want to understand it, right? And that's, again, that's also where the assumption that we can treat animals the way that we do in Western societies comes from, right? If we're a top dog, we can do whatever we want because we won the evolutionary race or whatever, right? But in scenes like those in Jurassic Park, there are two things going on. So one is that these were actual animals that at some point existed, right? And that we're at some point as dominant as we are today. And the other is that when you put us face to face without all of our technological barriers, right, we would lose. We would be the prey, right? And that makes us deeply uncomfortable because that is not something we've experienced for 10,000 years now. So I think that's part of it. That's a big part of it, if you ask me. And you know, later in the movie, there are some references to how that turning of the tables makes you reconsider some choices, right? I go back to the scene that happens right after they witness how they feed the raptors. I don't know if you remember, they have this big cow, right? And they lower it into the pen, and then they don't even show it. You just hear it, right? And you see their facial expressions. And the scene then cuts to them having lunch, and they get served fish, I believe, or some sort of meat, right? And they can't stomach it anymore, right? Because they realize my understanding of that scene is not only that they realize that they're essentially doing the same thing as the raptors, but also I think if there is perhaps a bit of empathy on their faces for the cow, right? How is what they're doing any different, right? And then how is what the dinosaurs do to them later on any different? So I think there are some sort of, there are instances in the film where it does kind of challenge some philosophical assumptions that we make on an everyday basis about our position within the natural world and also our treatment of other species.
In the movie where they rescue the boy from that dinosaur island, there's this scene where they're stuck in that cage for flying dinosaurs. And in that scene, it is highlighted how flying dinosaurs are just those scary creatures, truly. But then, at the end of the movie, they are in a plane or a helicopter, I don't remember, leaving for good the island. And then they see a pack of those flying dinosaurs in the horizon. And the whole scene is made to symbolize hope around those flying dinosaurs, you know, flying in the horizon. And it feels like a moment of hope or a dreamy moment. And I kept thinking they should have been panicking from, you know, looking at that pack of flying dinosaurs escaping the island. What do you make of that scene? Why did they code the scene as, you know, something hopeful?
Yeah. Hey, so the first thing that I would say is that the third movie is full of questionable decisions, right? So perhaps part of it is just the fact that that movie was not that well thought out. But, you know, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and assume that they were trying to suggest something, right? Which is often the case in films, right? There's some sort of message. There's a point to everything that happens. And I think one way of understanding that may have to do with the question of captivity, right? Which is also implicit in the first movie. So, and actually much more implicit in the book, but let us not speak of the book. But so one of my favorite books, and I read it only recently. So it's titled Fear of the Animal Planet by Jason Preibel. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. But so Fear of the Animal Planet is this attempt to bring out this hidden history of animal resistance, right? And what he means by that is that there are many instances throughout history where either individual animals or packs of animals or groups of animals seem to have come to this sort of breaking point, right? Where they push back against what could be characterized as some form of oppression, right? To give you an example, you might recall the film Blackfish about Tilikum, right? About the orca that was in captivity for so many years in horrible conditions, and it became murderous, right? I think that's the way it is described in the documentary. And the implication there is that that sort of behavior was a consequence of the way that it was treated, right? Now, if you look at Jurassic Park and its portrayal of some of the animals, admittedly not all of them, and I think, again, this has something to do with the fact that at the end of the day, it is a Hollywood movie, so it has to just be entertaining, right? But let's focus on the scene that you brought up. I mean, the animals in that scene, the flying pterosaurs, right? They are amongst the last creatures in captivity on that island. Right, they're still in that cage, and animals that are incarcerated like that are usually fiercely territorial, right? Because, well, their territory is tiny; they don't have a lot, and so they're not going to tolerate any other creature that might compete with them for the very limited space and resources that they already have. At the end of the movie, they escape partly because the people that went through there left the gate open, I think is what happens, right? And so they escape and they fly off. I think it would be fairly safe to assume, right, that just like a rehabilitated tiger, right, maybe highly aggressive in the cage, but won't necessarily go out and try to kill people when it's released back into the wild, right? An animal like this, a pterosaur, regardless of how big it is, right, if it has a certain innate behavior, like pterosaurs were most likely fish eaters, at least the species depicted there most likely fed on fish or carcasses, right? And it's no longer in this situation in which it has to be highly aggressive, then I think perhaps you can assume that it's not going to be that aggressive once it's released back into the wild, right? That it will hopefully, I think that's perhaps where the hope comes from, that it will revert back to its more quote-unquote natural behavior, which is not as aggressive as it is in a cage, right? That's something that I think a lot of people have experienced this to some degree in zoos, right? When they go to the aviaries, like the one depicted in Jurassic Park 3 and in the book, you go to an aviary and the birds there are all over you, right? They flutter all around you. And that is just a consequence of their very limited space, right? Birds in the wild generally don't fly at you. Generally, you know, there are exceptions, but generally speaking, birds are not going to fly at you in the wild. But when they're in a confined space, competing for resources on an everyday basis, they don't get to engage in the sort of behavior they would out when they're free. Then I think that's kind of what happens, right? So yeah, that's perhaps the way that I would read it. And this is something I used to teach Jurassic Park as part of my introductory courses to critical analysis. And one thing that I always brought up is the fact that at the end of the day, right, Jurassic Park is a zoo. And so I think a lot of what happens in that film can be thought of as commentary to the way that the kind of behavior that people, that the industrialists and the capitalists in that film engage in, which is the commodification of life forms and such, it's a direct critique of zoos, right? So that's perhaps one way to think about it, that perhaps the hope is not, you know, people hope, but hope for the animals to find a better life, right?
That's an interesting point you're bringing up, and I want to get back to it. But first, since starting this conversation, we have been pretty, I guess the word is, direct and honest about animal behaviors. Something I don't see very often with, you know, communication around animals and veganism and the type of stuff activists say to the public. So, for instance, they will highlight how chickens are incredibly smart. They're so smart they can do this and that, and they're also very cute. And but of course, if you ever had chickens, you know that it's not the whole story. And there's this tendency for activists to just, you know, exaggerate reality to make animals into a cuter, smarter version than what they really are. What do you make of that, you know, manipulation of, you know, how we see animals?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think like with most of the conversations that go around or that have, well, really on any topic, but in regards to animals, animal liberation, animal rights, and just our understanding of our relationship with animals, I think there are multiple sides to the story. The ones that come to mind are, well, there's it's what I would understand as two sides of a spectrum, right? So on the one hand, it's the utilitarian sort of activist perspective of this, which is we understand what people find appealing, right? We've known this for a while, if for no other reason that we see it in the domestication of certain animals, right? We seem to find certain features and certain characteristics quite endearing, right? Amongst them, of course, is intelligence. We do value intelligence above all else because of, you know, you may call it narcissism, but it's because that's what we have, right? We as a species came we became this hegemonic, this prominent because of our intelligence, right? Not because we're faster or stronger or whatever. We used a different kind of skill, and so we value when we recognize that skill in other creatures, right? And so from an activist perspective, it's just a matter of efficiency, right? If we know that people respond to certain characteristics like intelligence and cuteness, right? Then anthropomorphizing animals in a way that that makes them resemble us more is a very viable strategy, right? And I think it works really well in that regard because it's just what people seem to respond to. Now, the other side of that perspective, or, you know, the counterpoint, is that philosophically speaking, and in terms of, you know, if you're playing the long game kind of thing, the ongoing prioritization of certain characteristics that we associate with ourselves, right, is not a long-term solution, because what it does is it perpetuates the hierarchy that exists. It just kind of extends it, right? So whereas before we used to think that perhaps only people should have rights, then we kind of expand that circle, like Peter Singer puts it, right? We expand that circle, and now chimps and whales and animals that think like us kind of fit in there, right? But then we're like, well, actually, you know, we see that some of those characteristics are also in chickens and cows and such. So we expand that circle a little bit more. But I think the problem with that sort of approach is that there are always going to be life forms that are excluded from that circle, right? And I think you don't even necessarily need to look at other species. One of my favorite philosophers is Carrie Wolf, who's written on philosophical understandings of animality and such, right? And one sort of like thought experiment that he proposes is that, okay, so like if you decide that to grant rights to a life form, it must fulfill certain cognitive capacities, right? It must demonstrate that it has certain cognitive capacities, that its intelligence levels are at a certain threshold, right? You can easily look and find people who, because of disabilities or genetic conditions or whatever, are not going to meet that threshold, right? So it kind of shows you the limits of that approach, right? And likewise with animals, I think, you know, anthropomorphizing chickens or pigs, like in the movie Babe, right? It can be a very effective method of getting people to think about how we're actually not that different, right? And that perhaps we should give them more consideration, that we should think more about the way that we relate to other creatures and other species. But I do think there are limits to that approach. So, you know, I can't tell you whether I think it's, or rather I can tell you that I don't think it's the most effective way to go about this in the long run, right? That I think true animal liberation calls for a complete reconceptualization of what we value, right? And so focusing on cuteness or intelligence is not the long-term solution, but I think I do see the benefit of making gains wherever we can, right? Because I also understand the situation is dire. So yeah, I guess I kind of oscillate between those two positions.
I mean,
worth a bit.
Not only that, but there are other people speaking to the general public, people who are pro, let's say people who are anti-vegan, you know, pro-hunting, pro-this, pro-that, and they say, hey, those vegans don't know what you're talking about. Those vegans are city people who have never had a chicken, who have never met, you know, a goose or something. And what they're talking about is it's just bullshit, you know. Let me show you a few videos of chickens hunting a mouse. Look at how cute they really are. So no, you know, don't trust them. And so we've put ourselves in that position by, I guess, in a way, lying to people.
Yeah, I think you're right. By the way, you just reminded me that there is this really short, I think it's one of those TikTok videos, right, that I really appreciated, which was, it was a chicken, I believe, hunting a mouse or some, like, a vole, some small rodent, right? But it was over, like, the video played over the Jurassic Park soundtrack, which I thought was brilliant, right? Because, yeah, I mean, that's essentially what you're watching. Yeah, you're right. I think that's something that I overlooked just now, but it's a perfectly valid point, which is that it also kind of makes some of these arguments less convincing to the people who perhaps do spend time with these animals, perhaps not under the most ethical conditions, but who understand their behavior perhaps a little bit better, or at least they understand it well enough to see that some of this, some of the anthropomorphizing that goes on in these campaigns is just flawed, right? It's just not, it has no basis on reality. You're absolutely right. And I think that's a perfectly valid point to make. Although I would also counter that perhaps there is very little you can say to a hunter, in my experience, that'll sway them, right? Because perhaps they're also the ones that are going to be hardest to convince, because their relationship with animals has, you know, is longstanding. They're usually people having hunting for years or since they were little, right? So they become desensitized to it. And so perhaps they're the last people you should be worried about, because they're the last ones you're going to convince of anything at all, right? Recently I had I was following this conversation around the Calgary Stampede, which is one of the biggest rodeos in North America, right? And there were people protesting in Calgary, and they were protesting the exploitation of animals in the rodeo and rodeos in general, but specifically at the Calgary Stampede. And some of the cowboys, I guess you would call them, right? The actual people participating in the rodeo, released a number of statements or went on YouTube and TikTok and such to try to, like, clarify some things. But there was this one particular video that stuck with me, which was, again, right, one of these cowboys talking about how they were justified in their treatment of animals. First off, because otherwise most of these horses would be slaughtered since they have no use. And second, because this is just their culture, right? This is the culture of the place, and that people who come to this place should, and I believe the phrasing was verbatim, they should learn to enjoy it like everyone else. And I thought it was very telling, because that's exactly what happened to that person and everyone else, right? They learned to enjoy it because since they were little, they were indoctrinated into thinking that this is actually something that they're justified in doing, right? And so they learned that this is a valid form of entertainment, right? Unlearning that is complicated, right? So I don't think that people who are deeply entrenched in a certain subculture that has a particular relationship to animals, like hunter and prey or cowboy and cow, right? I do not think they're the first people we should go after, because frankly, right, they are the people that are the least open to these arguments. And second, they are in some ways a minority, right? Most people today don't hunt. Most people today don't ride horses for fun, or, you know, engage in all these rodeo practices for fun. I think that's safe to say that most people don't do that, right? What most people do is they go to the supermarket and buy meat, right? They go to the supermarket and buy chicken wings and steaks and eggs and such. And I think those are the people that we should be thinking about, because they're the ones who have not been indoctrinated like that, right, to that particular relationship with animality, but rather they are blind to the fact that these are animals, right? There is no direct relationship between the animal and their everyday life, because that has been, cut off, right, through the processes of modernization and consumerism and what have you. They don't have a direct relationship with the animal. So in that case, I think establishing that direct relationship is important. And then perhaps, again, right, that's when you can think of anthropomorphizing as a somewhat valid way, or a fairly valid device through which you can kind of start developing a more direct relationship with an animal that is not based on consumerism.
Yes, you're very right about that. You remind me, this morning I was reading an article from Big Ag. It was titled "Debunking Anti-Meat Lies" or something like that. And it started with, do you remember every Sunday the barbecue in summer, you know, the family? And it was just, you know, building the foundations of the pathos, the nostalgia, because that's all they have, you know. They don't have concrete arguments to present, so they have to rely on the conditioning of people. And okay, so let's get back to Jurassic Park. And you mentioned a few moments ago how it was a critique of zoo, and I agree with that. At the same time, I think this movie franchise has prepared the ground for a new market, which is the market of resuscitating animals that have been extinct for sometimes centuries. And I'm talking here about Colossal, the biotech company that has, you know, created those, what do they call them? Mice, mammoth mice, something like that.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I thought you were talking about the dire wolves, but yeah, before that came the mammoth mouse.
Yes, the mammoth mouse.
The mouse myth. I don't know what they called it, but.
And then the dire wolves, they also resuscitated the dire wolves, and they want to do the same with mammoths and woolly mammoths. And at some point, they hope to do it with dinosaurs. So, recreate basically Jurassic Park. What do you make of that?
Well, first off, I would go back to this other podcast that I used to listen to, and and I remember that it was structured around problems and solutions, right? Problems like social problems and solutions to those problems. And and this one time, one of the podcasters brought up genetic engineering as a solution, right? And those two were always bickering, and that was the format of the podcast. So the other person went out and found a counter argument to genetic engineering, and this stuck with me because I thought I found it hilarious, first off, but also it's so on point, right? So he starts reading this FAQ section from a company that genetically engineered a certain kind of salmon to grow faster and produce more meat and, you know, supposedly lower its environmental impact, right? And he's reading the answer to one of the FAQs, and the question was, how do you make sure that these salmon do not, like, contaminate the genetic diversity of wild salmon? And the answer was, all of our salmon have been genetically engineered to precisely with this in mind. So they're all female and cannot reproduce in the wild. And the guy on the podcast, he says, man, this is the plot to Jurassic Park, right? Like, how did they, someone unironically wrote this and did not realize that they're essentially making the same mistakes they make in Jurassic Park, right? And I think that is so telling, because you can have films, right? One of the reasons why I love narratives, right? Why I love stories is because of, you know, the fact that, and everybody knows this, right? They have a message, they have a moral, right? And I think in regards to Jurassic Park, there are a number of messages, there are a number of critiques and questions of morality, right? And one of them is precisely like, what happens when you temper with the very fabric of life, right? And I think that's not a new question. It's in many ways a reimagination of Frankenstein, for example, right? Prometheus, in some ways, is also kind of related to those questions, right? But what's interesting to me is that you have all, like, we have these cultural texts that tell us perhaps we shouldn't play God, right? We shouldn't be messing around with things that we do not really understand. We shouldn't just, like, as Malcolm puts it, right? We should ask whether we should before we ask whether we can. And I think, unfortunately, now we see it, like, technology has gotten to the point where this is, some of the sciences in Jurassic Park are now potentially a reality, right? And we have companies like Colossal that do it not with the explicit purpose of making a product, at least not yet, right? They're not like, unlike this salmon corporation, right? They did not have mammoth fillets or whatever, mammoth steaks in mind. They were not making a product they would sell for people's consumption just yet. But I think we can assume that is the goal, right? At some point, the people who are working on the Pleistocene Park, for example, in Siberia, they have explicitly talked about the possibility of opening up hunting within this reserve, right? As a way of, like, generating revenue, because otherwise they cannot perpetually rely on grants, for example, right? So I do think that at the end of the day, because we operate, or all these corporations are corporations that operate within a capitalist system, whether the explicit purpose of it is to generate revenue or not, they have to, right? They're in a position where they have no choice. And so ultimately what this will result in is the further commodification of life forms that, you know, have essentially no rights, because as they say in Jurassic Park, a genetically engineered form of life that was created has no rights. It's property, right? It's intellectual property according to the law. And so it'll be understood that way. And it's only going to perpetuate the system in which we do not give any ethical consideration to creatures that are not us because of whatever excuse we can think of. One of them being, well, we created it, so, you know, we own it. Now, having said that, I think Colossal is particularly insidious, right? Because not only does it do this, but in addition to that, they lie about it, right? As you might know, the dire wolf is not a different kind of wolf. It's just a regular old gray wolf, which is an endangered species in some jurisdictions, right? That was genetically modified in, you know, in, I don't understand to what extent, but I know that the purpose of that modification was to make it resemble a dire wolf, right? I mean, you have to question whether there's any scientific merit to that, right? Again, the only real reason I see to do this is to show that you can. There is no real merit in it because you're not bringing back an extinct species. Not really. This isn't de-extinction. It's genetic modification of a species that is in many places protected, right, by law. And we can talk about the merits of conservation and all that stuff, but at the end of the day, it's just experimentation, right? It's experimentation on a creature that is intelligent, that is sentient, that I think we should value for purposes that are not just entertainment or almost whimsical, right? Oh, can you do this? Oh, yes, we can. Look at this. Here it is. But so what, right? It doesn't accomplish anything. Now, they're thinking about other... They've talked about other species, right? There's a Tasmanian tiger, which I think if they manage to clone something like a Tasmanian tiger, I think then the conversation becomes a little more serious, right? Because that is a highly distinct species that you can't just take another marsupial and modify it into resembling a Tasmanian tiger, right? You can't do that to a Tasmanian devil or whatever. You have to actually recreate the entire organism. And, you know, the ecology of places like Tasmania and Southern Australia, where these animals used to live, has been severely degraded as a result of their extinction, right? So perhaps you can think of the merits of introducing a species or recreating a species that is sorely missing in its native environment, right? That's a different conversation. But what Colossal is doing is not that yet, right? And again, I think that because it's ultimately a corporation, right? It'll trend towards you know, making a product that they can sell. At the end of the day, that's what it's going to be. That's what I fear.
And they're making, sorry for my language, but a shit ton of revenue. I think that the CEO and founder has just been added to Forbes' list of billionaires. So he's a billionaire now. And that reminds me of my first contact with this new science of resuscitating or creating those kinds of mutants that resemble extinct species. And that was back in high school, believe it or not, from reading Science Magazine. And they had an article that started, you wake up in the morning and you feel there's something weird. You can't quite, you know, point, you know, what's weird. And then you continue reading and you realize, the protagonist realizes that he's in a zoo and that an alien species has, you know, cloned him and brought him back from who knows what era. So humanity has been extinct and we've been brought back, which is the plot of a horror movie of the, you know, alien kind. So, you know, are they going to go as far as resuscitate hominids? Do you think that they will cross that line at some point?
Yeah, I think that's the kind of stuff that, I mean, if I were, I'm not a business person, right? But I can imagine that, well, you know, they say that bad publicity is still publicity, right? There's no such thing as bad publicity. So perhaps this is an ill-informed take, but I wonder, you know, if attempting something like that wouldn't be hugely detrimental to their perception in the public sphere, right? Because I'm thinking that wolves, as much as people do like wolves, I think most people have some sort of admiration for this particular species, right? It's still considered wholly other, right? It's still not people. And so it's okay to put them in zoos in most people's eyes. It's okay to, you know, occasionally seek them out in the wild, maybe domesticate them. Some people hunt them, right? So I think that's one thing. Another thing altogether is to attempt to bring back a species that's essentially us with an asterisk, right? I don't know. I can imagine there would be lots of resistance to that. And I think perhaps that's the point, to just kind of stir the conversation a little bit, right? To see how far they can push people and still, you know, have a favorable kind of public perception. One thing that perhaps is worth thinking about in relation to this is, I don't know if you remember, it's not that long ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, there were claims that a human being had been cloned in China, right? And before that, way before that, in the early 2000s, when cloning first became the talk of the scientific community, the question of whether human cloning should be allowed was a more public conversation that was being had at that time, right? And as I remember, people were largely opposed to this idea, right? So I think that they would also, I would hope that people would be opposed to the idea of bringing back a creature that would be so like us and yet not really, and thus open to exploitation, right? I don't see that happening, but that's the thing with, and again, right, that's what Jurassic Park tells us. That's the thing with scientific technologies like that, with genetic engineering and the fact that all of this is being done by private corporations now, is that you never know, right? The industries are so deregulated right now, and there are so many ways in which they can conduct research that's highly questionable, right? And not be in any way confronted by the public, because the public just straight up doesn't know what's going on behind closed doors, right? They don't know what's going on in those labs. It's entirely possible they would attempt something like this, right? So who knows? I would like to believe that people wouldn't stand for it, but people stand for all kinds of things, so.
There's something funny about, you know, the idea that there might be a clone of Albert Einstein in a Chinese lab right now.
yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because I think as an alternative to this, right, could be, and you know, I'm not an advocate of AI technologies, but I recently saw this thing, where this kid made an AI version of his grandpa so that his grandma, who was now widowed, could talk to him again, right? And so if this technology exists, and I think its ethical quandaries are not as dire as, you know, human cloning or the cloning of species that are human-like, right? Then perhaps we should favor that over cloning Albert Einstein, right? Isn't it just possible to create an AI version of it? Although, of course, there are philosophers of AI who would perhaps debate whether that artificial intelligence would then be entitled to certain rights and considerations. But that's beyond my understanding. I can't say that I know much about that.
Last question about Jurassic Park. A theme throughout the movie, at least in the beginning, in the first movie, is the wonderment of the paleontologist looking at those dinosaurs and being able to touch them and to look at them, you know, closely. And I guess this kind of wonderment, we all share it for nature, and it's that very reason why they created that park, because they knew people would travel to go and look at those creatures. So how do you explain how this movie resonates so differently with different people? You know, like, for me, it is a reason to, you know, be kinder to animals, and it is a critique of zoos. And for others, it is a motivation to create the very thing that the movie, you know, is denouncing. So, what do you make of that diverse response to Jurassic Park?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I think it's. It's one that's difficult to answer, but I'm going to try by referencing something that we talked about earlier today, which was the place of paleontology, dinosaurs, and evolutionary theory in society's understanding of the self. I think you're absolutely right in pointing out that there is an almost instinctive sense of wonder that we feel in the presence of nature, right? Whatever you want to call nature. But I think that instinct, or perhaps some, you know, feeling that we all have deep inside, I think it can be shaped, right? So when people stand in the face of these wonderful creatures that we share the world with, that affect, that feeling, right, will then be sort of channeled depending, or through your worldview, through the ideologies, excuse me, through the ideas and ideologies that have shaped you. Excuse me. So once that affect kind of surfaces within the body, right, the mind, my understanding of it is that our understanding of the world, like our cognitive understanding of the world, which is always going to be shaped by the society that we live in, it's going to warp that sense of wonder, and it's going to transform it, right? It's going to channel it in a particular direction. And so even though we all share that sense of wonder, the way in which we project it back out into the world is going to be different from person to person, right? Although there are some trends, I think a lot of people feel the urge to be close to this natural world, right? And I think that's where the drive to own pets, for example, comes from. I've met a couple of vegans who used to own exotic pets, right? And I think even though most hardcore vegans would describe that as a contradiction, I think while it might be a contradiction, I think it's also a manifestation of this deep-seated love and admiration that we feel for the natural world, right? And then later, as you learn more about, for example, the exotic pet industry, you realize that that's not the right way to channel that affect, right? But that's not often the case. Most often, the way in which that emotion, that feeling will be channeled is, again, right, shaped by your society. And if your society is one that understands animals as objects to be owned, for example, you go and get a pet. Especially after watching Jurassic Park, you go and get a pet that resembles a dinosaur, right? Or conversely, you watch Jurassic Park and see them, you know, what, quite frankly, the majesty of predators, right? And perhaps you that affect is then channeled into an urge to go hunting because that's what you know, right? So I think that's partly why we can all agree on the fact that most people, I think, even people who otherwise care very little for the environment, we can all agree that there is something about nature that attracts us, right? That something about it that is that allures us into wanting some sort of relationship with it. So I think that's partly where it comes from, right? And I think it's also why biodiversity, you know, animal conservation, wildlife conservation has been such a pivotal piece of the environmental movement, right? Because I think it's one aspect of nature that most people respond to in some ways. And so it becomes an easy way to like generate donations, for example, right? Or sign people up to volunteer or whatnot, right? Which is why I study representations of conservation and extinction and things that have to do with biodiversity, because I think that it's one of the few things that really seem to generate some sort of consensus about the need to protect the environment or nature or whatever. Now, having said all this, I think that thinking of this feeling as a sense of wonder, right? I think that is the right way, or I shouldn't say the right way, but I think that is the way in which I would encourage all of us to channel that affect, right? There is this line. It's the last few lines of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. And I can recite it almost verbatim because it urged me to reshape the way in which I understand my relationship with nature, because I used to be one of these people, right? I used to be one of those kids who would watch an animal documentary and want to get one of those animals as a pet, right? And I had countless exotic pets when I was a kid, the pets that I did not know how to take care of. And that unfortunately most of them died because I was just a kid. I didn't know it, but there were no limits to it, right? So I would ask my parents for a turtle and they would get me a turtle. I would ask them for like a lizard and they got me a lizard or a snake or what have you, right? But then reading this passage really, really made me kind of like rethink how to understand that feeling, right? And it goes something along the lines of how there is grandeur in this view of life. That from so simple at beginnings, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. And what I like about that passage, or one of the things that I hang on to is the concept of the view of it, right? Because I think that sense of wonder you're talking about that we experience when we watch Jurassic Park or a wildlife documentary or when we go to Yosemite or National Park or whatever, right? It doesn't need to be anything other than an affect. It doesn't need to be anything other than a view of the world, right? It doesn't have to be more than just this sublime experience. Perhaps learning to just think of it as a way of seeing the world as opposed to as a way of owning it or claiming it or even like visiting it, right? Because our impact to the places that we visit is huge, right? And we shouldn't be in some of these places, right? So I think that, learning to just feel that and not do something about it, I think that's the way that I think we should strive to be. Obviously, it's difficult, and again, I don't blame people for doing things a certain way, right? I think we're all the product of ideologies, and so there's very little point in blaming people for doing certain things. I think it's more about like perhaps encouraging them to rethink some of those, some of their impulses.
Is it ideology or are we just a predatory species?
Yeah, good follow-up. I think a lot of it is ideology. Look, one of the conversations that I have a lot when people ask about my veganism or veganism in general, right? It's like, okay, but like, what about, and then, you know, fill in the blank with some sort of society that is not yet fully Western, right? Like, well, what about like, I don't know, like the nomads of the Kalahari or the Inuit in Northern Canada and such and such and such, right? I think that evidently we're a predatory species in the sense that our evolution was shaped by this transition that you see in the fossil record towards the consumption of meat, right? How that meat was procured, by the way, is not entirely understood. It's possible that hunting was not what drove that transition, but rather scavenging, right? I mean, you do have to remember that the few apes that inhabit the African savanna today, or primates, no apes, primates, right? Like the olive baboons, they're carnivorous, but they hardly ever hunt. They mostly scavenge, and that is because other animals have taken those apex predatory positions, right? But anyway, the point being that I think that, yeah, like it's in our instinct in some way, right? But I think it's also true that in that sense of wonder and in that recognition of the grandeur of nature and furthermore, you know, the fact that we just, most of us right here in Western societies do not need to do it, right? I think that challenges the extent of that predatory behavior, right? I think most people would hesitate to kill the animals that they consume on an everyday basis, right? Like even somebody who really loves chicken wings would be hesitant to kill enough chickens to then have a platter of chicken wings, right? I think there are limits to that predatory instinct. And I think that again, our understanding of that consumer-based relationship to animals today is mostly, maybe ideological is not the right term, but I think it's the product of external forces, right? I think in no part of our genetic code is there, a line that says, go to the supermarket and get a steak, right? I think there's a difference there. I don't know. These are the tougher questions to answer. I think entire volumes have been written about that. But personally, I think that perhaps that's one way in which we can think of ourselves as different from most animals, right? And even then I would question it, but we're not entirely driven by instinct, right? We acknowledge that on an everyday basis. Otherwise, society as we know it would not be possible. So why stop at not killing somebody who makes us angry, right? Why stop at not harassing people that disagree with us? Why not extend that control over our instincts to our fellow animals?
Yes, it's an interesting question. I think you're Right. If people are interested in learning more about this and exploring this topic, I actually interviewed Dr. Ahituv, who led one of the first research showing that our ancestors were mostly plant-based in their diet. So yeah, go look that up. I think it's episode 68 of the show. So
yeah, absolutely. I will look it up because, you know, I teach critical analysis, and so I'm all about like paying attention to the details of any utterance, of any statement, right? And so when I hear arguments like our ancestors were carnivorous or hunters or plant-based, right? I always ask which ancestors, right? Because human evolution is long, right? If you date back to, you know, if you're talking about our ancestors as in like primates in general, right? And especially even primates in our family tree that were basal, they were overwhelmingly plant-based, right? Very few primates in the wild are otherwise, right? You do have some tribes of chimpanzees that hunt, but for the most part they're plant-based, right? So when I say that like some of our ancestors do seem to have exhibit some trends towards carnivory, right, that occurs at a very particular time in human evolution, right? And it's also within the great scope of human evolution, it's a fraction of it, a tiny fraction of it, right? Not enough, for example, to give us a gut that can actually process meat, right? Which is why we have to cook it, right? Very few people struggle eating a raw banana, but most people will struggle to digest a raw piece of meat, right? So that transition that I was mentioning before, I should qualify that, right? It's not like the defining moment of human history. It's one of several moments, right? And I think it's the blink of an eye in evolutionary terms, right? And it's not long enough to have shaped us entirely. So we may have predatory instincts, but they're not the same kind of predatory instincts that drive my cat, for example, right? Who cannot survive without meat. So, yeah.
Yes. Don't feed your cat a plant-based diet. I know I might get, you know, a bit of strong reactions from that comment, but I stand by it. And yeah, I wish I was more, you know, pushing back on some of the claims, you know, observed and reported on in his study, but there was a language barrier. Anyway, I got the scoop on interviewing him on that study. I know it was, you know, viral online when he published it at the beginning of the year. But yeah, I was happy to sit down with him. So Alex, do you want to add something before we stop the recording?
No, just, you know, again, my name is Alex Ventimiglia. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Alberta in the English and Film Department. I mostly research environmental documentaries that have to do with conservation, extinction, and environmental justice as well. And, you know, and I try to, I guess I would encourage people to learn more about the many ways in which environmental issues interconnect, right? I think the conversation has been hung up on climate change for quite a while without truly understanding what drives it, for example, without truly understanding the ways in which it connects to other issues that are longstanding, right? I would encourage people to go watch the new David Attenborough documentaries, which I hope to discuss with you at some point, because those are something that I'm very interested in. David Attenborough, for example, yeah, I think most people know him, right? He was, for the bulk of his career, he was apolitical, right? Because that was the tradition of the BBC, specifically the BBC's Natural History Unit, to produce apolitical documentaries, right? And that the situation is now so dire that there has been a very marked transition in the way Attenborough communicates his environmental message to the public. He is now embracing the you know, the concept of a plant-based diet. I think he doesn't use the term veganism because unfortunately has a lot of negative connotations, but he's spoken about, you know, the how crucial it is to change our relationship to the natural world, beginning with what we put in our bodies, right? And a big part of that is, letting go of that, of that carnivory that has added very little to us as a society, but has been so hugely detrimental to the world, to nature, and to the lives of billions of creatures that are sentient and vulnerable and that can't speak and thus are easy to ignore by most people. So yeah, definitely check that out. You know, inform yourselves, learn about the ways in which all these issues sort of interconnect, how they all intersect. And, you know, if you care about pandas, if you care about tigers, if you care about all of these beautiful animals out there, right, a good place to start is always with your own bodies, right? And letting go of those things that we consume that put those other creatures that we do admire and that we do love in jeopardy as well.
Nicely said. Alex, I love your takes on all of those topics and questions. This was such a pleasant conversation.
Yeah, it was. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and please come back.
Absolutely. If you ever need like a last minute guest or whatever, I'm always happy to join you. Yeah.
Oh, not even, you know, I want to have your take on the movie Babe. And I also want to comment that documentary and documentaries in general. I think, you know, there's a lot to be said about them.
For sure. Yeah. So for instance, like the last one that came out of that new school of documentaries by Adam Borough, Ocean, right? Ocean now with a markedly political message, anti-trolling, anti-fisheries, right? It was so sorely lacking for all of last century, but it's gotten to the point where people who care about the environment like David Attenborough can no longer pretend that these are not issues, right? So which is why he stepped away from the BBC, or at least he's now in partnership with Netflix as well, Disney, right? Corporations that are more open to political messaging. Surprisingly enough, Disney being one of them, right? But yeah, no, absolutely. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about whatever you want. But I'm always happy to discuss films because I do think that there's a certain power to the moving image, and that encourages us to reconceive our understanding of the world, right? So yeah, let's talk about all that.
Definitely. See you soon. Thank you everyone for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.